Hey everyone, it's Libba Beecham, Interim Executive Director at the Northeast Georgia History Center, and today I'm speaking with computer historian and author David Grealish, who will be a special guest presenter during our May Homeschool Day, the Information Age. Now, this is going to be on May 22nd. That is a Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And this homeschool day is open to all who wish to attend and learn about the advances of communication technologies, beginning in the early 1900s all the way to the modern era. Now, David Grealish is the author of Classic Computing, and he's written numerous articles, including those for Time Magazine and Forbes, and he has produced a great documentary titled Before Macintosh, the Apple Lisa, which explores the history, technology, people, stories, and industry influence of the lesser-known personal computer. So I'm really excited for today's conversation. David, welcome to Then Again.
Thank you, Libba. I'm really happy to be here.
So I really want to start from the beginning. Can you share a pivotal moment from your early life that really sparked your passion for computers? Where did it all begin for you?
So, and I do have such a story. And actually, I opened my book, you know, with my kind of my story, and I talk about this. So a pivotal moment in my life was I was in the fifth grade, 1975, you know, here in Jacksonville, Florida, where I live now, my hometown. And we took a field trip to the University of North Florida and visited their computer center. And so they took us into this big room and they sat us all down at what looked like these big typewriters. So again, 1975, there's no screens, okay, just these giant typewriters. And they put two of us each by each one, maybe 25 kids or whatever. And suddenly they all came alive and like started making all this noise and typing away. You know, this is like the what you think of as a green bar paper, you know, the continuous fed green, white bar type of computer paper. But then it started writing stuff and like making big giant letters out of, you know, little alphanumeric characters. So welcome to the University of North Florida's computer center, blah, blah, blah. And then it asked our name, and Thomas was my partner's name from the class. And so I typed in David, he typed in Thomas. And then again, in big letters, it goes, welcome David and Thomas. And I'm like, oh my God, it learned my name. And from that moment on, I mean, now this is on top of another, at least for my life, an important thing. And that important thing was Star Trek and the syndication of Star Trek. And, you know, so already I saw images of for a few years at that point, that's when Star Trek was really building after it had been canceled in the 60s. You know, in the future, one day, computers would just be easy to use because we just talk to them, you know, computer, blah, 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 and it'd answer your question. And so I knew computers would be in the future, and this proved it, even though this is way primitive than what I saw on television. But from that point on, I just like, I want to do something with computers. So I was 10 years old.
Wow. What a fun experience too, because I mean, that must have felt just so magical. And there really is something, especially for a lay person like me, who's not the most technically savvy, especially compared to someone with your background and everything. But I can imagine that just being this, such an important impression on you as a kid to think this is the beginning of the future, you know? And so since then, over the years, you've been involved in many, many projects and contributions to the preservation of computer history. And so you're going to be presenting on the history of computers as we know it during our homeschool day. Could you give us some highlights from your own work that can kind of shine a light on the overview of computer history? What would you consider the first computer, and where do we kind of go from there? And then we'll dive into some projects that you've worked on.
I was actually just talking to someone about this other day, like there's lots of pivotal moments in all kinds of history, right? But some of the pivotal moments, and you've experienced them, I won't ask your age, but I'm certain you've experienced them in your lifetime. And I'm going to focus it on personal computing and consumer personal computing. So generally what is considered the very first commercially successful mass-produced personal computer was called the MITS Altair. And it was in 1975. But really only really engineers and computer hobbyists here called really took advantage of this thing because it was very difficult to use. You had to use these front panel switches to do anything. And without going into too much detail, keep the story kind of short, it wouldn't be to 1977, fast forward. Another pivotal moment was the introduction of true consumer computers. So you have the Apple II, the Commodore PET, and then the Radio Shack TRS-80 Model 1. And these were Arguably the very first computers that a normal person could buy, take it home in a box, open it up, set it up, and do something productive, minimally productive, you know, from our vantage point, right? But
now, what were those kinds of things that the early computers on the consumer side, what kind of tasks would they help
well, with? And so in 1977, even though these were consumer computers, and then programs, pre-written programs started coming out for them, but those earliest people, all they could really do is run BASIC and or buy a game and run on it. And then you had to program your own little, you know, oh, I want to keep an inventory at my business, or I want to word process or whatever. But pretty quickly, you know, games happen, right? And that's driven the industry. But then word processing. And then a little bit after that, the spreadsheet. There was a huge innovation. And then that grew. But so the other big innovation, I'll tell you, is I think is, and it fits right in with my documentary, was the graphical user interface. And that's what we all take for, you know, granted nowadays with, you know, what you see is what you get, using a mouse, pull down menus. It's all graphical, right? Instead of a DOS based or, you know, green screen, if anybody can imagine that. And we're all using that right now. So 41 years later from the Lisa, 40 years from the Mac. But, you know, Windows was a big part of that. And then whether you use Android or you use an iPhone, iOS, you're still using basically another part of graphical user interface, just your fingers, now your mouse, right? But it all traces its roots back to the Lisa. And that's a big part of the story of my documentary. So I would say that's a huge, big pinpoint in computer history. The next one I would point at, and again, there's so many other ones you could point to, there's the hardware evolution too. So everybody had a desktop, finally laptops, portables came on the scene, ultimately handhelds, right? So that's another big part of the evolution. But in just using a personal computer, probably the next big one was the internet. So late 90s, early 2000s and forward as it really got, you know, just common. You know, in 1995, you could walk into a big corporate office with 100 cubicles, 100 people using a computer, and they weren't even networked. There was no internet. And they still got work done. Nowadays, you walk in that same office, the internet or the network goes down, you know, game over. Work stops, right? So that change over to that is the next big, then the other big one that's been in your lifetime and mine is, especially is the smartphone. Because a smartphone, and this ties in with the presentation for homeschool about communications, because the smartphone really is a handheld computer in every sense of the word, other than the obvious limitations of its size. And you know, you don't have a keyboard or a mouse right there. So you got, you know, so maybe it's too small sometimes or not. But now it's kind of transformed into it's a computer at all times, but it's a communications tool. Even though I get a phone is always a communications tool, but you know what I mean? Like using the computer part of it and using social media and stuff, it kind of now is a hybrid computing, you know, communications tool.
It seems like such a enormous leap in such a small amount, short amount of time. I mean, it's something that I can't even really like connect it to something else, that piece of technology that has leapt so far in such a short amount of time. And given your perspective, I mean, is that just because it became so useful that innovation led to a big focus on computing? I mean, what are your thoughts on how are we able to go from the most basic computer that you experienced when you were 10 years old, even though that was very, very cool at that time, to this graphic interface that, I mean, it really does feel magical in a lot of ways. And there's just this intuitive part of it that we totally take for granted now. And we'll talk about even the future of AI being involved in a little bit. But from your sense, I mean, is there anything you can compare it to? Or is this something that's pretty unique in human technology evolution?
So, and I don't remember the exact quote, but there's like a saying that kind of goes along of, you know, people with their own accomplishments or innovation, you know, I stand on the shoulder of giants or whatever, right? Like somehow, even though everybody's praising me for what I did, you know, but I built upon this other people's work, you know, without them, I couldn't have done it. And, you know, and technology innovation, at least what we're talking about, it's absolutely the same thing.
Yeah.
Because again, if you look at those primitive computers of the mid to late 70s, I mean, there's a lot of growth and evolution that came about till we finally got the 2007 with the iPhone, which was still like magical, wasn't it? But that was already 20 plus years into computer technology. And then the ever downsizing, ever growing aspect of microprocessing and integrated circuits and stuff. And that in itself in computer history was like a miraculous innovation. So, you know, the miracle of the integrated circuit happened in the 60s, and that was taking a physical transistor, which was magical compared to the vacuum tube, and then putting 1,000 of them on a little dinky chip instead of having to have, you know, 1,000 of them, like all literally wired together by hand. So it's just everything just builds. But I think a good analogy is like the, even with the user interface and other stuff, is the automobile. So think about how much, you know, arguably, we'll start with like the Model T and Henry Ford, and they're being mass produced and becoming more consumer based or whatever. I mean, it innovated and it still does, but, you know, just off the top of my head, by the 20s, you know, 10 years, 20 years later, things are pretty standardized about what a car should, how it should work, what it looks like. You know what I'm saying? There wasn't too much, you know, they had four wheels. There were always exceptions. Steering wheel, right? Gears, brake, accelerator, speedometer in front of you, and so on. So,
and now we have computers in our cars.
Yeah. But if you think about the, like the smartphone, for instance, when people had ideas about a smartphone, it was meant to be a handheld computer, which it is. But even people, when they had that idea, and I know this is audio only, but I was showing you like a Palm handheld I have, which is not a phone. It was a little handheld, very limited little computer, right? But that was the, you know, the promise of the future, is that soon we can carry our computers around with us and have the world's knowledge at our fingertips. And we have that. But you know, it happened to also just sort of merge into our telephone. So we have the, yeah, I don't know, when the telephone became common, I don't know if anyone ever thought we'd be carrying them around with us at all times, right? Remember in the 30s and the 40s, maybe, I think the next big step was the TV phone. We can see each other while we talk.
Oh, no, that's fun. Yeah,
you know, that's the future. Fun. Think of like the Jetsons.
Oh, right. I doubt
that. When they're thinking about the future, exactly. They didn't think, I don't know if the people, now Star Trek had personal communicators.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Right. So I mean, Star Trek seemed to have some pretty good predictions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having, studied the history of the computer and also being involved in the preservation of actual like historical computing artifacts, I would imagine that, I mean, are there fairly rare artifacts that you've come across and have been able to preserve? And I'm also just curious about what the challenges are to preserve computer artifacts. I feel like it's something that folks may not immediately think of when we think about, you know, artifacts and antiques and these old tools and technologies of the past. But talk to me about what it takes to preserve these items and the rarity of any particular ones that come to mind.
So, of course, I'm going to answer from my perspective and my own history and, you know, experience and stuff. But
yeah.
I'm going to start off with a joke. Okay. It's not completely a joke, but what is the difference between a collector and a hoarder?
You tell me.
Space,
yeah. Yeah, I can relate to that, yeah.
Now, in all seriousness, the difference is hoarders are generally ashamed of their hoard.
Yeah, yeah.
And collectors are proud of their collections. They want to show them to you, right?
Yeah, right.
But in all seriousness, I think when the big issue is space. Yeah, you know, because even if you're collecting just, you know, laptops or, hand, you know, if you're really into it and you're a completist, you really want to collect, it can take up a lot of space. Now, I started collecting in 1993. So I was kind of, you know, revolutionary, if you will. That was, you know, because old computers were absolute garbage and trash. Man, okay, I didn't use that word. You know, back then, and people put them out on their curb and everything. They do that still sometimes. Well, now they put them out, you know, they have to take them to the e-waste, right? But so I was able to acquire a bunch of stuff pretty quickly and easily, but then I ran into issues of space. And my wife at the time was very kind. And the first 20 years or so of our marriage, I was able to have the full two-car garage. And it was full of my collection. And I had ideas that, so kind of more better answer your question too, I try to keep them clean and just do basic maintenance on them to keep them running. I'm a real big believer in, you know, to try to have them work, you know, restore them literally.
Yeah, that's an interesting piece of it, that these most of your collection were still
operable. Yeah, because I played with them too, because as a hobbyist with that, I think, like, even again with cars, maybe people that collect old cars, I'm going to drive them around once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like Jay Leno, I don't know if you ever watched his channel, but, you know, he's taking them out and driving them.
Oh, yeah.
but I built, I had ideas and dreams of starting a museum, and, you know, I have a regular job. And I had a family, I have children, and they're grown now. But, you know, the realities of the world kind of made it kind of not possible for me anyway. And ultimately, I still have a collection. I have some stuff and nice stuff to show, but nothing like them. Ultimately, I sold off some of it. I gave a lot of it away. Yeah, I tried to preserve it, though. Like, I never just trashed any of it. But now I don't have that anymore. But I'd say that's, you know, the time, the space, the, you know. And you got, I think all collectors can fall into this. You have to, you know, and I ultimately made a decision too that, you know, if it's spending most of its time on a shelf in the garage and I could barely even get enough time to dust it off, it's not doing me or it any good.
Right, right. And it's the kind of, they're the kind of artifacts that I can imagine that museum, it would appeal to many museums, since so many museums focus on technology and obsolescence. And so.
And it's starting to more and more. They're still kind of underappreciated, I think, but they have their place.
We're very lucky here in Georgia and Roswell to have the Computer Museum of America here, which will also be one of our special guests at the homeschool day too. So I am really glad to see that there is more of an intentional focus on these things. And for, you know, speaking of your collection, I'm curious to know, are there any particular artifacts that are just very special to you, or your favorites that you have?
So, I think if I have to state one computer as my all-time favorite, it won't surprise you, but it's the Apple Lisa. And I have a history with that. I don't own one now, unfortunately. I can do some real basic maintenance and keep on running stuff, but I've had a few of them over the years, but the last one I had, it stopped working, and it probably needed new capacitors where you have to desolder and do a lot of that kind of stuff. And I didn't have the time or the means, so I sold it and let somebody else work on it. But the Apple Lisa always has a soft place in my heart, and I could talk more about that. But as far as what I own right now is, I don't have an original, but I have a reproduction of that very first personal computer, the MITS Altair 8800. And I'm really fascinated by those kind of computers from that time frame. And I have another one, which I was going to show you, but I know we're not on video. But it's another reproduction, but it's kind of a hybrid in the sense of it's not old, but it works like the real thing. Versus my Altair looks exactly like a brand new version of the original, but inside it's all what's called emulated, you know, so it runs and looks like the real thing, but inside it's not really the real thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, because you're basically saying, like, we're using modern technology to emulate what the experience would have been like then.
And just for instance, one of the biggest differences, if you look inside one of these machines from the mid 70s, and I'm trying to think of the exact term is, but they had power supplies that were giant in there with these giant capacitors and everything. I think they're either linear or they're not linear. I can't remember at the moment. But this doesn't have that. You know, modern power supplies are way more efficient and smaller. But that's, you know, and they weigh, like, my reproduction, it's so light, but it looks authentic. But the real thing would weigh like 40 pounds.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And I know that you've focused on the Apple Lisa with your documentary. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Apple Lisa means to you and why it's particularly special to you? And I encourage folks to check out Before Macintosh, the Apple Lisa documentary. If you could let folks know where they can watch it.
Yeah, and I'll start with that. That's okay. So if you just do a search for Before Macintosh Vimeo, then that's where you can rent it or buy it. And then, of course, download it or stream it if you buy it. Or if you go to my webpage, it's classiccomputing.com. There's a link there. But I'm working on getting it distributed and then other streaming service. That takes some time, though, and effort. But to answer your question, so this is in my introduction of the film. Through most of the time I was making the movie, I was not going to be present in it. You would not see me or hear me. And then I changed my mind kind of the last minute because I thought, and I'm happy I did. It worked out great. But I tell this a little bit longer version of this story. But I worked at an Apple dealer in 1989 in Gainesville, Florida, where the University of Florida is. And I was convinced the Macintosh was the future. This is the future of computing. I don't want to own one of these IBM compatible DOS machines. But I had no hope of affording one. Even with a discount from the Apple dealer. And one day this guy, I'm across the store, and this guy's struggling to get in the front door, and he's got this big giant Mac, it looks like. And I'm like, what? Yeah, what is that? And then he goes over and he goes to the service department and then he leaves. And then I go over to the service department. I'm talking to the technician and I'm looking at this thing. And what is this? And he goes, oh, it's a Macintosh XL or an Apple Lisa. Never heard of it. What? I've never heard of this. I mean, I know about the Apple II, the Apple III, you know, at the time, Apple IIc, Apple IIe, you know, all the other Apple computers, the Mac models, never heard of this thing. So, back then, pre-internet, you know, and I work at an Apple dealer, there were two main magazines, Mac User, Mac World magazine, and I would eat them up every month, you know, read through them. And then one day, like after this, I noticed this ad in the back, and wow, look at, here's this company called Sunry Marketing in Utah, and they're selling those machines. And in fact, they're selling them where they're upgraded and updated to be like the low-end Macintosh at the time, the Mac Plus. And so, couldn't afford the Mac Plus, even with a discount, but that Lisa upgraded was $1,095 in December 1989. I had one credit card. I was in college, and I had just enough on the credit card to buy it with shipping and get it. And then it was upgraded to run as a Macintosh. So I'll try to keep this short. It became my first Mac. So it didn't run the Lisa operating system. It ran the Mac operating system. And then from there, I learned how to do desktop publishing. And then I ultimately became a computer tech, a Mac tech, and then ultimately Windows and so on. The rest is history. So, but I was so fascinated by it, as well as I loved it because it was my Mac, is I just started digging into its history. And that just kept blossoming into the history of the Macintosh, the history of Apple, the history of personal computing. It just became my hobby. And then, you know, fast forward a little bit, like say by 1993 or so, I started collecting them and started writing a newsletter. And fast forward a little bit more, and I do a web page, and I start doing podcasting, and then I do a book on Kickstarter, and then I participate in a little documentary where I make a short, and then I go, hey, maybe I can make a documentary. And around 2018, I had that idea, so then here we are. So, oh, and I start writing, you know, I'm doing articles and interviews and all kinds of stuff. So just in a nutshell, the Lisa, it's played such an important part in my life. And just all around, you know, it was a catalyst to everything.
I love that story. And it also, I just want to commend you for all the work that you've done to preserve this history too. I would imagine that there are many folks out there that are also very much invested in this topic and the history of it. But, I mean, it also seems like something that would take a lot of work and a lot of obviously deep interest and passion to share all of this. So I'd so appreciate that. And I, of course, we'll have links to the Vimeo link for your documentary, Before Macintosh, the Apple Lisa, as well as your website where they can learn more about your articles and your book, Classic Computing, as well. And I'm kind of curious, you know, since we've talked about a lot of technology and how it's advanced, is there any piece of technology or computer or otherwise, just from your perspective, just as a fun question, that is obsolete today, but you really wish we would bring it back into popular use?
I mean, from a practical standpoint, no, specifically, maybe that question. But I kind of think this will be a related commentary. So in the documentary, you know, I also touch on a little bit of the history of the graphic user interface that led up to like consumer based, like we all use now, and the, you know, the Lisa, the Mac, and then Windows ultimately on the PC side of things. But you know, these are also built on earlier developments and technology. And so a lot of this research and this stuff happened at Xerox. And most people don't know this, but in the late 60s, Xerox was very, very forward thinking and innovative. And one day their board, I guess, said, wow, you know what? Our entire company is built on paper. What if paper goes away one day? We're you know, we'll be messed up, right? And so then they built the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and they started researching, you know, paper, the paperless office, it was called. So the reason I bring that up is there's a very important guy there named Alan Kay. And he came up with a concept, this is early 70s, called the Dynabook. And the Dynabook was a book-sized computer that had all the power of a supercomputer. So finally, you could have, you know, we finally really step into the information age where we have the world's knowledge at our fingertips. And that was the promise of that. And then we have that. And it's incredible, right? And so there's so many great things we can say about the smartphone. So not exactly answer your question, but I think the smartphone is equally one of the greatest things ever designed and one of the worst. I really think it's like, you know, our society, our culture, and that's the world, yeah, the first world, I guess, because, you know, but, you know, it's got its downside, right? And everybody's their face in it all the time. And everybody, I won't go into that, but you know what I mean? You go to a restaurant and...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I, in a way, you know, I've even noticed in my peer groups that, I mean, even or even on like when I'm on social media, what's being advertised to me sometimes are dumb phones, quote unquote, you know, because of that kind of, we're humans, we're going to be fixated to that, you know, dopamine rush of the likes and the scrolling and all of this, you know, it's to our detriment at times. So it's interesting to see us kind of go revert in a way back to a more simple technology that won't take our attention. And that's kind of what I was kind of, wanting to lead with that question is that, I think that there is some benefit to simple technology that because a lot of the more advanced technology, like you said, it's caused some challenges for us.
Yeah. And I, you know, and all humor aside, I honestly hope we don't end up like Wall-E.
Oh, yeah, right. Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah, you know? Totally. Totally.
We even got Amazon. We even have, what was the name of the corporation, Big and Large or something? But
yes.
We have that, it seems like.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a really important piece of this entire history, you know, is the effect and impact. Like you said, there's been amazing, seemingly like miraculous technology, and yet there is this double-edged sword.
But I think it'll balance and, out. I'm generally an optimist, and I believe it will balance.
Yeah.
So hopefully.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, if we look to the future, what are your thoughts on where computer technology or communication technology might take us? If we wanted to, you know, be the folks who were thinking about what the Jetsons life would be like, that's sort of us thinking to the future. What are you excited about? And I guess going back to the other topic, what are you concerned about with the future of communication technology?
I'm not so kind of going backwards with that. I'm not real concerned with AI as far as being scared of it. I don't like the idea that, you know, I have a Google Home device and an Alexa, and I have a Google phone. I mean, we're all being monitored, if you will. But I'm not too worried about that, though, at least right now. You know, I'm not saying I'm not at all concerned, maybe a little bit, but I think AI is overhyped in the sense of the Terminator AI and or something that can truly be so, you know, I think therefore I am. Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? I love this Star Trek word where you're self-aware. What's that word? Do you know what I'm talking?
Sentient. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I think we're way off from any AI to be sentient, where it truly becomes a life form and it can think on, you know, and then it's going to kill all the humans and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So the other part of your question is, I guess, I think like I have a Shark brand automatic vacuum cleaner, and those things are great. I think we'll get more of that and utilizing AI in that way. And again, I do like the Google Home and the Alexa and stuff, but the future, I don't know, we're kind of at a plateau. So like you were talking about, look how quickly like the smartphone evolved. So the smartphone is plateaued. It's not even been 20 years. And certainly the personal computer. So I think, was it just this year, the new Mac OS came out, Windows 11 is out.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Sure, everything keeps evolving, but come on, how different is it really?
Right.
Yeah, your new Android phone or your new iPhone, is it really that different, you know?
Right.
Now I know the Apple goggles are called, or the Apple Vision. Yeah, that's kind of the new thing.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's all plateaued. And even the graphical user interface and the paperless office paradigm, the desktop, you know, it's running out of steam, or you think it is. What's next there? I don't know, be honest. Yeah, and I don't know if talking at all times is really practical or going to work, or we're a long way off of it being that good.
Right. No, that's a really
interesting point that you make. Speak on the Apple Vision. The big, I can't afford one, but I don't want one. And I can appreciate it a little bit, but the biggest way people, it looks like, want to make fun of it is, you know, someone puts it on YouTube, they put it on, they start walking around down the street.
Right.
And then of course you look ridiculous. But I don't think it wasn't intended to be used like that.
Right.
You know, so augment your reality when you're in your office, your home, you're in a room basically, or space. And I can see that. I don't want to particularly do it, but I can see it.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like though it takes some, pretty massive innovation to get go up from that plateau. But it's especially for someone like me, I can't even imagine it. And even when I use like AI, you know, AI tools just like pop up now as options, you know, even in like, you know, when I'm designing something in Canva, it's like AI tools, I'm like, what? Okay, you know, and so it seems to be sort of like the population dipping its toes into this new era of at least being assisted with AI. And I'm really curious to see where that's going to take us. But I mean, just going 100 years ago, you know, to today, we can see just a gigantic leap. And it's really, I'm really curious to see what that next leap is going to be like for us. And so David, we're coming near the end of our time today, but I did want to encourage folks to check out your resources. You have many awesome resources to learn about computer history. And also want to remind folks that on this is going to be Wednesday, May 22nd from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's when our homeschool day all about the information age is going to take place here at the Northeast Georgia History Center. Everyone is welcome. If you can attend our homeschool day, then come on down. But David, as a conclusion for this chat, do you have any resources that you could recommend folks? We've talked about your book, Classic Computing, which is very exciting. We talked about your documentary Before Macintosh, The Apple-Lisa, and we'll have links to those in the description. But any other resources that you'd like to share with our audience, especially younger audiences and maybe
I
teachers?
Yeah, I mean, other than my own things or whatever, which just I'll just mention real quick, by the way, at my webpage, if you go to the About Me link, then I have like a lot of thing important thing. I feel that I've done my most important things that you can click on. Like, for instance, that computer, the Altair, I actually interviewed Ed Roberts. He was the creator of that. Oh, it was one of the earliest interviews I ever did, 1995. And so you can listen to that. And it actually, the written, it exists at the Computer History Museum in their archive. So it kind of turned out to be kind of important. He didn't do a lot of interviews.
That's
fantastic. If you're interested in that, listen to that. I think it's really good. And his story is really great.
Yeah.
And, you know, my articles, you can link off to some of them. But you mentioned the Computer Museum of America in Roswell, just north of Atlanta, just north of Sandy Springs or wherever. That's a beautiful museum. And I know Lonnie Mims, the founder and the creator. We worked together to help start the first vintage computer festival Southeast. So there's a kind of like a car show. There's a vintage computer festival that happens here. It's happening in July.
Fantastic. In, I definitely want to do that.
Marietta area, near the ballpark. So vintage computer festival Southeast. So if that's cool. And there's like a gaming convention. The museum is great. That's those are probably the two key things in Georgia, you know.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I'm really excited to learn about the computer festival, too. I mean, that sounds like an awesome opportunity, especially for any of the kiddos that get really interested in this. There's lots of resources here in Georgia. And I believe there's even a society or a club or guild in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I came across.
I meant to mention it. Yeah. I founded that.
That's so funny. That's so funny. What a great connection.
Well, because I'm in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah.
But I was there for 12 years. So the Atlanta Historical Computing Society.
There you go.
So that's a local little club, and everybody, you know, they get together and help each other and fix computers and talk and do whatever. Yeah. So absolutely.
I think that's how I got connected to you when I went down the, you know, wormhole of trying to find, you know, who can we
And they run the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast.
Oh, fantastic. So. That's great. And I wonder if you might be familiar with Southern Fried Gaming Expo.
Yes. So the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast is now in conjunction with that show.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because we're going to have Preston on at the homeschool day as well. Preston's going to be showing off the retro games and whatnot. So that's going to be a great reconnection.
And that's become really popular, you know. And again, like I said earlier, you know, gaming, even now, it still drives the industry in lots of ways.
Especially like the
advancement of graphics and stuff, of course.
That totally makes sense. Yeah, excellent point. And there's so much more to learn. So I'm really looking forward to your presentation. This will be a virtual presentation. So it's kind of fun that we get to connect over computers and over a system of communication that's so familiar with us these days. And David, thank you so much for joining us again, folks. The links are going to be in the description. And I really encourage you to check out David Grealish's resources and his website, documentary, his book. And especially, I hope that you can make it to our May 22nd. That's going to be Wednesday, May 22nd, Homeschool Day, about the information age with our special guest, David Grealish. Thank you so much, David. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. Thank you again. It was fun.
Then Again is a production of the Northeast Georgia History Center in Gainesville, Georgia. Our podcast is edited by Andrews Gilles. Our digital and on-site programs are made possible by the Ada May Iyoster Education Center. Please join us next week for another episode of Then Again.